The yawning part this morning. Peter's still resting. He'll be here shortly. And suggested that it might be good to do a little bit of meditation together. So let yourself find a way to sit that's comfortable and relax and at the same time present, alert. Maybe put your feet flat on the floor and sit upright, but with a sense of graciousness or ease. And if you're comfortable, let your eyes close gently or open softly if you're not. And in keeping with the spirit of what Peter has been leading, let your attention come gently back to your own body and breath, how your body is breathing itself on this spring afternoon. And simply begin to notice with a loving awareness your experience, embodied presence just here and now. Bring a quality of loving awareness to this breath and to the body just here and now. Feel how it wants to breathe itself and let things open in any way they will, held in a caring, loving attention. Simple, stable. And whatever is present just now, bring in even more kindness. See what happens. And last, take a deliberate deep breath and let out a nice ah. And magically, as you open your eyes, Peter has reappeared. And I have one request for you, Peter. If you get to it this afternoon, and probably be in it, to somehow talk about collective and social trauma. And I know you've done it at 9/11 or in, you know, war zones around the world. But when we look at Palestine and Israel and the kind of trauma cycle, or Yugoslavia, or even in our culture with Native Americans and African Americans. So there's the collective trauma. And how do we deal with that and use what you've understood to stop the cycle of trauma? Yeah, and that may not be where you start, but it would be a great thing if you're able to. All right, let's get your mic on and we'll see what happens. Uh-huh.
Exist? Okay, whoops. I think it might be not quite on. Oh, maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm losing. No, it's not on. Yeah. Gonna have to work around those hearing aids. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I will say a little bit about that because otherwise I might forget. I mean, you see throughout the world how wars between neighboring nations seems to erupt every certain number of years. I was involved at a peace conference in Dubrovnik right at the end of the war, and I was just kind of calculating, talking to some historian people, and it looked like every 20 years there'd be some kind of conflagration. And I thought, well, what is there about that? And what came to me was, of course, when you're in war period, there's a tremendous amount of stress. And people who were born into that take on that stress. And then when they grow up in their 20, was the number that I came up with, then they can easily be talked into having another war. And you see areas, of course, like in the Middle East, again, where you have these cyclic intifadas, whatever you want to call them, conflagration. And this is probably one of the most important lessons I've got in where it really fits in with the whole idea of groups meditating, but also in being able to work with their traumas. I remember when I first started coming to Germany in the early 80s, nobody talked about the war. Nobody. And then when we were doing sessions in the practice sessions, of course, what came up was the war. But I really believe it took about 30 years before people were ready to be able to look at that. But it was clearly operative. I mean, I even remember, like, I was also teaching in Denmark around the time, and I was teaching at somebody's beach house, and some German tourists, you know, asked how to get to some place, and my Danish friend said something like, "You go this way, and we don't want any bratwurst." So these kind of hostilities, even in peaceful countries, just continue to linger. Then when I was doing a class, this was before the last Intifada, so that was 15, 16 years ago. I was able to do a workshop, a training, for a group of Israeli and Palestinian therapists. And somebody asked the question, well, if you don't know what trauma a person has, can you work with them? Because in most therapies, you have to have a trauma that you know. And I said, oh, yes, that's what we do all the time. We don't have to know anything. We just have to know what symptoms a person's experiencing, what behaviors are troubling them, what kind of hauntings of one kind or another they have, or just wanting to be curious and coming up and exploring. So, and I said that, and then I asked, is there any... Oh, no, I didn't even ask. This man immediately put up his hand, and I said, come here, and his name was Chaim. He doesn't mind me telling the story. I don't think he's alive anymore. And he was a psychoanalyst and had pioneered the psychoanalytic treatment of Holocaust survivors. And he had been having severe back pain for 30 years. And so we started just to see what was going on in the body. And then... all of a sudden he feels the tension that's underneath the pain. So a lot of times when people feel pain, it's difficult to get at the sensations that are actually underlying the pain. So as he was able to get in contact with the tension, and I asked him, because I could see a little bit of twisting, I said, is the tension more on one side or the other? Yes, it was more on the right side. And then I could see his body starting to turn, and then he felt dizzy, like he was going to faint. So I just came up and put my hand behind his head so he could have a little bit of support. And then I'm looking, and there's water around his feet, and he's sweating profusely. And then he opens his eyes and says, I know what this was. Well, he was an army doctor 30 years ago, and his convoy was ambushed. And everyone was killed, and there was horrible things happened even after they were dead. And he fell off the truck and fell on his back in a ditch. They didn't notice that he was there, so he survived. So there was a whole lot of complicated emotions, including the horror of what he saw, and also the guilt, the survivor's guilt. So we work with that, and I could see, you know, people in the group were really sobered. And so I don't always do this, but I asked if anybody would want to share what they were experiencing while Chaim was doing the work with me. And some people shared, and then this one woman, I'll never forget her, she stood up and she was wearing a gray flannel, a business jacket. Very handsome woman, very striking woman. And she said, Chaim, when you came up to work with Dr. Levine, I prayed that something horrible, something terrible would happen to you. But then something happened and I can't explain it. As I saw you work, even though there were no words, they were unspoken voice, something shifted in me, and I felt such compassion for you and for all of us, because I have so much hatred, because you've tortured my people, you've killed my people, you've humiliated my people, but somehow that got washed away, and I realized, Chaim, that until we find peace within ourselves, we will never find peace with each other. And I think we have to hold this together with things that we can do in group. Maybe we'll have time later to show some models that we experimented with to work so we don't get these traumas passed on necessarily to the next generation. And also to bring people together around something that we all care about, which is our children. Oh yeah, I'm just remembering also in Zagreb last year. You know, again, I was at this conference right at the end of the war. The war was 92 is when it ended. 95. It ended in 95. Yeah. So there was nothing happening there in Croatia, really. And so Tatiana organized something there, and I went there. And again, what started to come up was the war. I was on a TV program, and again, we were able to talk about the war and the effect that has on all of us. Because nobody, whether you win or lose, escapes the trauma of war. But there are, again, things that we can do to rebuild ourselves, our psyches, and our communities so that we have a choice, either war or cooperation and compassion. Compassion and cooperation. I mean, I think that's truly the only alternative, you know. And I know, Jack, you've been working in a lot of different areas where there's been strife and war, and how we can begin to find ourselves and find each other. Because the one thing we share with whatever side we were on, the one thing that we shared is the experience of trauma of the war. Ah, yeah, I remember, again, when I first started to do work in Munich, in Germany, one woman who I did a piece of work with, her father was in the SS. He was in the Gestapo. And she worked with tremendous shame and guilt and the suicide of her father. And then there was another young woman whose parents were in the resistance. And again, you could see how it was the next generation, but how they connected with each other because of the shared trauma. So these are given in the human condition as it is at this point of evolution. But there are things that we absolutely can do with each other so that we can minimize this. The other thing that I've studied, I was going to maybe mention at the very end, which is related, is the idea of generational trauma and how that profoundly affects us in ways that we can barely imagine, but it lives within us in one regard, as though it were happening to us, even though it didn't. But of course, that's the confusion there as well, because it didn't happen to us. So in working with generational trauma, we have to help people separate it, what they're experiencing from their own present reality. I remember working with a number of people, this was a while ago, and they would sometimes experience, some people were experiencing burning flesh. And somehow they knew it was human flesh. And a number of these people were vegetarians. So it's not likely they would be, smelling much, experiencing much burning flesh. And then when I started inquiring, it turned out that these were children of Holocaust survivors. And I thought, well, how do these things get transmitted? This is, I wrote about it a little bit in Waking the Tiger. I think I had a chapter, How Far in Space and Time. And I really puzzled over it. I really puzzled over it. And when I was writing Trauma and Memory, talking, the last chapter is about generational trauma, I came across this interesting experiment with mice. They exposed mice to the smell of cherry blossoms, which, I mean, they're certainly not offensive. If it's a neutral, but probably positive or neutral. And then what they did is they would give the smell, shock the animal, and they would do that a number of times. So usually in a week or two, this is classical conditioning, you give the smell of the cherry scent and the animal freezes and defecates. No, that's no big thing. except I don't know why they did this. I really need to try to make some contact with these people. But they had the idea to then expose the fifth generation, so the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of those mice, they exposed them to the scent of cherry blossom, only cherry blossom, no other smells, and they froze and started to shake and tremble and defecate, as strong as their great-great-great-grandparents had had. So that's, okay, that put it together for me. Now, I'm also see myself as an evolutionary biologist, or certainly influence evolutionary biology. Oh, hot chocolate. Whoa.
There's also some hot water.
I think maybe I'll dilute it down a little. Oh my God. I hope I'm able to function. Whew. I have a feeling they put in some brandy. So okay. What was it? We have a chocolate gremlin. No. Okay. Awesome. So I thought, what the heck? You know, what a mechanism like this where you're transmitting trauma from generation to generation. What adaptive value is that? What good is that? And then, speaking again of large-scale disasters, we responded to the Southeast earthquake tsunami, where many, many, many people, hundreds of thousands of people were killed, all the way from Thailand to southern India. And one of the things that we learned was that the people who were tribal people, as soon as the earthquake happened, they ran to the hills. And remember, the last time this happened was 300 years ago. So nobody has any kind of conscious memory of this. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, they tell legends and pass on that information through story. But then the fact that they immediately knew to run, and then also that the elephants and other wild animals, as soon as the earthquake happened, they also went to the hills. So virtually no wild animals died. So, okay, so that makes sense. So then this information is also useful information. The bad stuff comes also, but so does this useful information. And then that finally put it together for me. When I worked with this particularly young woman, I was living in Colorado, and there was a flight, was flight 232, that was going from Denver to Chicago, and the rear engine exploded, and it cut all the hydraulic lines. So the plane was uncontrollable. Miraculously, they were able to make some kind of a control by just increasing and decreasing the power in both of the front engines, the wing engines. And they landed in a cornfield in Sioux City, or a regional airport, and then scattered into a cornfield. And the pieces, many of them, burst into fire, into flames, the fireballs. And amazingly, almost maybe even more than half of the people survived. And the pilot who I got to interview, the only thing he knew was all the people that died and his guilt about that. He had to retire after that. And so, but anyhow, I was working with one of the passengers on the flight, a lady named Katie. And we came to a place where she had a procedural memory. her body memory of being upside down. Well, first in the work, actually found some images and some sensations that were very important of her sitting in the cornfield with the sun on her back. The reason why that was important is because that was the thing that let her know that the trauma was over. And as she let herself down, the fuselage was compressed, collapsed, but she saw a pinprick of light at the far end. And she started to crawl. She could feel her body, again, body memories, procedural memories of her body, crawling and moving towards the light. And then as she got out of the plane and sat in the cornfield, she remembered that both her... And she was also a Buddhist, so there was also the meaning of going to the light. And both her father and grandfather, father and father's father, had, and by the way, with the mice, the generation of transmission is more powerful through the male. If the male is the one that's conditioned for the fear, the transmission is even more powerful. And so both of them had been in airplane crashes, one commercial like hers and one military, and both of them survived by crawling to the light. So this information was passed on. A remarkable, it really is remarkable. So again, if we look at the negative part of generational trauma and that spread, there's also something very positive and very important about the ancestors. And a number of my students are also trained in this thing. It's not as well known in the United States, called constellations, family constellations, where they really work with the generational. And so that we are not just ourselves. We come here not just starting fresh, but we come bringing legacy and knowledge and traditions and a lineage. You're all here because you're getting transmission of a lineage. I mean, these are things, right, that were practiced literally thousands of years ago. And so for every time, there are new teachers, and these teachers are the present of the lineage. Okay, anyhow. Let's get back on track. Yeah. So what I'd like to do, and this is going to be a little bit tricky, I'm going to maybe try to combine the exercise I did just before the break with some basic tracking skills. And tracking skills are about this. Most of us are not really aware of specifically what we're experiencing. We might say, I feel impatient, or I feel really good, but we're not necessarily aware of what gave us that meaning. And in somatic experiencing, I developed a map of internal experience. It's called SIBAM, SIBAM. And S stands for sensation. And these are bodily sensations. In other words, sensations that are coming from within the body, sometimes called interoceptive awareness. And they can be muscle tension. They can be proprioceptive, where our body is in space. Here's a little exercise you can all do. I'll do it first. So I'm just sitting here, I'm talking to you, I'm conducting Beethoven's symphony or something like that. My eyes are closed, and I take my finger and I put it right to the tip of my nose. Try it. You're conducting. Yeah, and then put it to the nose. Then put the other finger on top of that finger at the edge. We can do it really quite accurately, and that's because of the information we're getting from the muscle tensions and from the position of the joints. kinesthesia and proprioception. Indeed, there's a very, very rare condition where something attacks the sensory neurons, and so these people have no sensory connection with their bodies. And it's a horrible, horrible condition. But this one man was able to, with watching himself in a mirror, be able to break down his movements into specific movements and sequences, and he was able to walk. It took him a year and a half at least to learn how to do this. And of course, if he were walking or standing, if he would close his eyes for a moment, he would just collapse on the ground. So it's such important information, and that's one of the reasons when I work with people, particularly when they're in shutdown, I don't work with them sitting facing each other. I will more likely tend to walk by their side, which is also important dynamic, important archetype, and work with them, and then explore the sensations that are going on, plus other parts of Saibam. So S is for sensation. They're also deeper than the proprioceptive and kinesthetic sensation are the sensations that are coming from our viscera and from our blood vessels. This is really from the James Lang theory of emotion, that all of our emotions come from the perception of these internal physiological states. Good. I wonder if I deserve it. Actually, who cares? As long as I'm getting it, I'll take a gift over deserving any time, actually. All said and done. So then there are, I stands for images. So these are things that originally come from outside, but we also have them stored somewhere in our brains as well. And images also include sounds, smells, tastes, and even touch, because these are what's coming from the outside. The reason I call it I is because human animals are we're very much visual creatures. Probably men even more than women, but we are very much visual creatures. So SI, I'm going to leave B out for now. And then we're going to go, because all the things I'm describing now are what the person is experiencing internally. Then A are affects, and they include, but not exclusively, to Darwin's categorical emotions, where he wrote in both The Descent of Man and in an incredible book called The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals. This is at least as great a contribution as his evolutionary theory. So anger, sadness, joy, fear, disgust, these are all what Darwin called categorical emotions that we share with all other mammals. But there are also affects that are different than that. You know, when you walk out from your, if you're staying here, if you walk out from your room here in the morning in this beautiful environment, and you see some dew on a blade of grass, and you're deeply touched, well, that's not an emotion in the Darwinian sense. It's not even joy. You're touched. And these softer affects, I think they're sometimes called contours of feeling. A woman named Singer called them contours of feeling. Eugene Genlin coined the term felt sense, and it's closer to that. And we could easily go through a day without a categorical emotion, but to not have these softer feelings, these affects, would be horrible. So that's A. And then M are the meanings we attach to our experience. So if we've been traumatized or shamed, all of those meanings will be beliefs around self-hatred, around insufficiency, whatever things we were made to feel. But what they're actually are, they're open to new meanings. So as we move through our sensations, our inner images, our affects, we now find new meanings. Again, that's one of the things I think you discover, I'm sure you discover in meditation. Some of the things you've believed for a long time all of a sudden shift. So those are meanings. B, now all of these things are things that the person, the experiencer, is experiencing. I don't have any, if I were doing something with you, and you know, with the, you would have to tell me what your sensations are, what your images are, what your affects are, what beliefs you have around this. I have no way of knowing that. I mean, even if I'm a psychic, and I've known some really good psychics, they can't really do that either. They pick up certainly information, but this is really in the interior of the person, and it's private. And then it has to be shared with you by agreement. Then in the middle we have B, is for behavior. And behavior is what the observer is able to observe, what the therapist or the guide is able to perceive. So, for example, I'm lecturing you here and I'm making movements with my hands, my arms, to emphasize things. If you go to a political rally, the politician says, "It's so nice to be here with you in Iowa." "Sir, you're in Minnesota." "I mean in Minnesota." So I do it voluntarily, although I want to convey something. So that's at the most superficial. Then we have the communication of our emotions through our facial expression. Then we have postural changes that can be very subtle, but if you're trained how to do that, and again, in the SE training, that's a lot of what we do, is learning to observe those shifts. We can then feed them back to the client, because the client mostly is not going to be aware of them, at least until they've had a lot of practice at it. And then we also have behaviors that are related to the visceral experience, because we see color changes, we see temperature changes, right? But again, the inner sensations, the tingling, the vibration, etc., those are internal experiences of the person. Okay, so would somebody like to come up and we'll just kind of do it? How about you, sir, way back in the end in the blue shirt? Refill. I think somebody must have tattled on me. When I'm in Switzerland, and when I come after a break, there's always some piece of a bar of dark chocolate. So, you don't have to do this, but you can if you want to think of an episode maybe that comes up in meditation which keeps replaying, but you have some doesn't feel good, or some experience you had recently which left you feeling some way unfinished or some haunting. And you don't have to tell me what it is. I mean, only if you want, of course. I'm sorry, what's your name?
It's Alex.
Alex.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah. So you say, I can tell you if I want to.
Yeah.
The reason I'm here today is in just the theme of trauma meditation.
Is, uh-huh.
Just the theme is enough to set me off. So,
okay. Yeah.
So I go back to a place of when I was sort of 8 years old, and that keeps showing back up.
Yeah. So I want you to feel your feet as they're contacting the ground. And noticing your hands, your fingers, your sensations there, and your breath, and knowing that you're here in this meditation class. Yeah, there. That's it. So I notice that spontaneous breath, so I know there's some settling. So I'm using all that. That's a behavior. So I'm using that information so I don't take the person right to an overwhelming part of the experience. So those are... Yeah. Oh, yeah, feeling your fingers and how they're just almost touching each other and they're like in a little bit of a bowl.
I'm completely overheating. So I'm just...
Feel overheating?
Sweating from my
whole
body.
Yeah. So again, just noticing that the heat, noticing the sweating, and just noticing if that increases, decreases, stays the same, or changes to something else. So again, these are what I call clean questions that invite exploration, but also invite things moving ahead in time, because trauma is time stops. It's about fixity. Whoa. So what I'm going to ask you to do is just slowly come back into the room, okay? Alex, right?
Yeah.
Slowly come back into the room, opening your eyes, feeling your legs. Yeah, orienting into the room. And just noticing how that is.
Yeah, it's better than having my eyes closed.
Yes. Yeah. By the way, you can do this with your eyes open or closed, whatever you choose, whatever feels best to you. And you can shift back and forth. Yeah. Again, just taking your time. Sensing your hands, your legs. Yeah. Right, your feet, your grounding. So I'd actually like to do a little exercise with you. And the idea, yeah, is to take a full, easy breath. And on the exhalation, to make the sound voo.
Voo.
As though it's... I'll demonstrate it for you, and then you can do it. Might want to have your eyes open for this part, okay? So I'm going to take an easy full breath. And as I exhale, I'm going to make the sound voo that's coming from my belly. And there are specific reasons for that. It's all about the vagus nerve and all that kind of stuff. Of course, it's also about things that have been done for thousands and thousands of years. So, noticing that lineage, and as you exhale, let the sound and the breath go all the way out, and then let the new breath come in, filling belly and chest. And then again, yeah, that's good, finding the right positioning. Again, very easy, softly, taking in a breath, and then... air and the sound all the way out, and let the breath come in, filling belly and chest. Ooh, nice, good.
Nice.
What just happened there?
So
I noticed behavior. You all did. Yeah. Change in posture, change in facial expression.
I was feeling the vibration in my gut and my stomach, and it felt good because it felt like it was pushing out that sense of constriction and the fear that maybe is it other times.
Okay.
So I was enjoying that sensation.
Wonderful. That's great. So this is where we want to be first. So where, when you do feel the constriction, where do you feel the constriction the most?
It's probably right in my solar plexus the most.
Right. Good. Then we're doing just the right thing. Right?
Say that again.
We're doing just the right thing.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So shall we do it just a little bit more?
Sure.
Yeah. And again, you can stop anytime you want.
Okay.
And you can just give me feedback as much as you want.
Okay.
Okay. And that's one thing I'm going to just mention. A lot of times as therapists, we feel the need to know what's going on in the person's images. I'm afraid that can be a little bit of unnecessary voyeurism on our part. So easy, full breath. Just rest. And just notice sensations, feelings, thoughts, any images.
There are. Do you want me to share them?
Only if you want. But I really want you to check to make sure it's something you want.
Yeah, but I feel much more grounded. I'm so connected to myself. I enjoy the simplicity of the exercise. I enjoy doing it with you. So that's sort of creating levity and lightness in me.
Great.
Sort of pushing out that story that creates the other response.
And so when you feel that levity, what are those safe sensations like? Can you describe the sensations?
So the imagery that I have is like in a champagne pond, like in a pond where there's bubbles coming up from underneath. So I'm being lifted up from underneath.
I think that's what I'm drinking. Boundaries.
So I'm also mindful of I was going to use the word attacking, which sounds a little harsh.
Of what?
Attacking that dark holding in my solar plexus.
Interesting. I mean, it's interesting.
Drive it out.
Yeah.
So interesting that I use that word.
It is. So I again, something like that I put in my mind. Attacking, interesting, don't know why, but got to keep an eye on that. And so I suspect that it's not so much pushing that image out as giving you a counter experience to which you can more safely, more objectively, in a way, with some separation, to look at that image.
Yeah, so exactly right. So to replace the old image with this. So the lightness, the idea of being held in a warm bath with bubbles.
Warm bath with bubbles. And as you said that, your hands went like
felt
this.
Good, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel myself supported in that. So I feel like I can actually relax a little bit.
Wonderful.
In my body. So, and that lets go. That unwinds that.
Okay. Well, that's terrific. Yeah. Again, just noticing what happens when you open your eyes.
I'm put my glasses on just so I can
look first without the glasses.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And then we can put them on.
I see a lot of shapes, and they're all fuzzy.
That's okay.
Outline of bodies as well.
Shapes, colors, outlines of bodies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, we're bringing in a new image associated with this internal state.
Well, I'm noticing it's just the uniqueness. I see so many different colors that the people are wearing in their clothes. And then that's really telling me just, you know, we're all as individuals as I am here as well. So that's allowing me to just experience what I'm experiencing without the shame that I often take on.
Right. Seeing all of the colors.
Well, that's a deep one.
And one of the things that I'm always fascinated with, I mean, I don't care if it's a room of 20 people or 2,000 people. And I look around and I don't see any two hairs the same. You know, like they tell you about snowflakes, that there are no two snowflakes alike. I mean, I don't know if that's true. I haven't actually tested it. But I do know for sure that in a room, as I look around, no two people have the same hair. It's as individualized, I guess, as one's fingerprints. So that kind of fascinates me. It's kind of maybe a quirk in my personality, but it's fascinating. Very fascinating. So if you're willing, or if you're wanting, to deliberately bring this image up into your mind's eye, the image that's, and just noticing that movement.
The old one or the new one? The old image or the new image?
Interesting. The new image.
That image.
Let's bring up the new image.
Yeah, good. Let's do that.
Yeah. Feel those movements in your shoulder.
Yeah, it feels good because I'm suspended in the water, so... Yeah. So I'm thinking of a real place. There's a real place. It's a large pond heated by thermal springs, so it's warm, naturally warm, and there are champagne bubbles coming. It's called the Champagne Ponds. So I can feel myself suspended in that water.
And like the jellyfish. Suspended,
but I have a
pulsing, flowing.
Nice.
Yeah, and those movements back and forth. Just noticing the movements.
Oof.
I just notice a lot of energy starting to move.
Yeah. So there was a lot of energy moving, so holding myself somewhat still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, sure.
Yeah.
I just love the image. I mean, the image that I have in my mind eye of the champagne pond. Where is it?
It's on the eastern end of the big island of Hawaii, where Kilauea is erupting at the moment.
I think I know where that is.
Yeah, it's in Kapoho.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we share that image. So let's do a little exercise here now, okay?
Okay.
Let's just deliberately shift between that image of the champagne pond and the image that was the troubling image. Just see if you can shift back and forth between those two images.
Too easily.
Hmm?
It's too easy. Yes, I can.
It's too easy?
Yeah, I can bring up the old images quite easily, yes.
Okay, and then when you bring up the old image, what are you noticing in your bodily experience?
It's what you were talking about earlier about disassociation. I just feel myself shutting down. Even now, my voice is starting
to
quake.
So feeling that shutting down. And as you feel the shutting down, let's go back to the vu, okay? Vu. sit feeling the trembling in your jaw and the little movements of your head. And just rest. And so I notice the breath, but it's not a free, spontaneous breath. So that's the behavior. I'm noticing, of course, the change in how he's sitting. He's now sitting more back in the chair. I don't know if I'm going to feedback. I don't know yet. How are you doing?
I'm feeling grateful. So.
And what's the sense, the physical sense of grateful?
Well, the physical sense is driving out the old pattern of disassociation where I tend to shut down and having something now with the voo and the resonance to be able to go ahead and actually have a tool that I can plant in that and create the change.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And actually, let's even work with another tool, okay? Something a little bit more active. Again, where they're shut down, what I'm doing, as you see, each time the person goes into the shutdown, I just allow them, I guide them to go into it a little bit and then coming out. And that's a key. Remember, with the Impala, not going into it all at once, but gradually touching in until the whole Sai-Bam changes from fixity to flow. So I'm going to have you just hang right here. Actually, probably put this one in your pocket because we're going to actually stand up now and do something a little bit more active. I'm walking around here. This is part of my traveling horse and pony show. I'm going to invite you to kick your chair back a bit and just stand here. So you're, right like this is fine. Okay. But what I want you to do is just get curious about this. Yeah. So finding that movement. And see where it takes you. Mm-hmm. And then again was a spontaneous breath and some shift here.
Yeah. So there's a focus of energy coming up in my chest that I'd probably name as maybe anger.
Okay.
So...
Anger. How do you experience the anger?
Just right now, just the clarity. I just feel very clear, very grounded.
Feel very clear.
Ready to go forward.
So. Oh, okay. So clarity. Got it. Yeah. So again, let's just play a little bit. Yeah, there it is. Now feel the anger part. Feel it right here. Hold it. Come down. Feel the anger part. Come down. There. And rest. Whew. Definitely rest. Oh my gosh. You were tall when we started, but...
I grew, yes.
You're definitely taller.
I grew. Yeah.
You feel that?
I feel a looseness in my spine.
And the looseness in your spine, exactly. Yeah, a lengthening in your spine and in your shoulders. And the anger, which really went to focus and clarity. Interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anger often does that. when you can feel it and embody it and then organize it. Mm. Yeah. Good. Yeah, so feeling again that kind of swaying movement. And just play with that. Mm-hmm. And gently, as you're shifting your weight from foot to foot.
I also had an aha moment just then, too, in that oftentimes, like I was saying, I disassociate, then I shut down. I think you were talking about yawning earlier. And so that's where I tend to go, and I get really fatigued and tired. And I just notice that I'm not. So to me, right. That was like an aha going, this feels good. This
yes, feels great. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
That's great. Mm. So let's maybe just do one more thing here.
Okay.
And just from where you are right now, if you look ahead and backwards at this image, let's just see what you experience now.
Oh, there's a softening in me.
A softening?
Softening, yeah.
Great.
So more of an acceptance, if you will.
So, ah, yeah. Okay. Acceptance. And feeling the tears. To me, they seem like tears of compassion. I'm not sure, but...
Yeah.
And whatever it was that he, this 7-8-year-old, went through, you're seeing it somehow in a different way.
Yeah.
In a compassionate way. So let's stay in contact here, okay?
Sure.
Is that okay that I...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I feel present. I don't feel like...
You
I'm,
do.
Yeah, I don't feel
really
like I'm
feel present.
Taken off like I usually do.
Yeah.
So it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Yes. Yeah. So... You don't have to say this out loud if you don't want, also. I'm just wondering, and if it seems a little artificial, sometimes it does, if there's something you would have wanted that 8-year-old to know or to have from where you stand right now in this embodied, compassionate...
Well, you were reading my mind because what I represent... What I give to the 8-year-old, the little boy, is to hold him safe.
To hold him safe.
Yeah, to create that safety.
Yeah.
Just the sense of what you were doing with this lady earlier, just holding the shoulders, just providing that blanket. So. Yeah. And from that place of compassion and...
Right.
Yeah, you know, inner strength.
Yes. Mm. Exactly. Because that's what he needed then.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. So again, let's just check, see how things look out in the world, and I will give you your glasses. You can just put them down somewhere, anywhere. And just kind of, just checking out first again.
I feel really tall.
I hadn't noticed. But again, that's behavior. And in a sense, my observing his behavior, arguably, lets him be more in contact with it.
Yeah.
I know, and you're kind of playing with me a little bit, which is wonderful.
Mm, yeah. But
yeah.
I feel tall.
Yeah, feel tall. And again, just scanning the environment for where you're... Oh, yeah, your eyes want to go. Mm.
Good, thank you.
Here's your glasses if you want to put them on and look.
Sure.
It's really nice. I probably should not have let you do that. But I think, just looking around again with your glasses.
No, it's fun to be able to see people. Recognize you. I recognize some people in here.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Those movements are exactly the kind of movements you see with a happy 7-8-year-old, 6-7-8-year-old.
Yeah.
Aren't I great?
You got it. I'll leave you the stage.
Yeah. So again, it was a T-shirt somebody once made after was having a discussion like this, and it said, "It's never too late to have a happy childhood." Again, I think that's one of the gifts that meditative practice can give us. It's not just calming the mind, but it's also, giving us what we had needed then, but what we didn't get then.
Huh.
Yeah. All right. So, shall we call it a day for today?
Yeah, but I can give you a.
You may.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
Sure.
Thank you
very much. Gladly. Gladly. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so now we have a group of assistants here, and maybe the assistants can raise their hands. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, so just look around. They're around. Now, again, you don't have to do this exercise, and I do suggest you at least do part of it with your eyes open. And again, the idea is really learning. Don't have to go through the whole thing like I did, but learning how to touch into those difficult sensations and with guidance to move through. So, I don't know exactly how you're going to be able to do this, but at least the chairs are freestanding. So I'm going to suggest that you be together in groups of threes and just take, maybe 10 minutes to explore your inner landscape. And you don't have to think of a time what was difficult, but you can. But again, best not to take something that was really horribly overwhelming at the time. Maybe something that you're a little bit angry at a friend about, or unsettled with a friend about, or something like that. That's still kind of playing in your mind, but it's not something where you felt, devastated. Because again, when we practice, we want to practice little steps. And then the assistants will be circulating around, so they're there. And if you feel you need some help, just raise your hand, and somebody will come there and give you a little assistance if you need it. And also, they may come in if they see that a person is starting to begin to flood, to come over and just give a little extra support. So that's their job to do that, okay? So let's move into, and again, you don't have to do the exercise, but I think it might be helpful to get some experiencing, and you can use the VU when you want. Shall we just practice the VU a little bit with the whole group together? Yeah, let's do that first. Where's my chocolate? I need a little strength. Okay. So, easy, full breath. And that's the key, not enforcing the breath. And then on the exhalation, making the sound VU, as though it's coming here from your solar plexus, from your belly. And very gently, let the sound, the VU, and the breath go all the way out, and then just allow the next breath to come in on its own, filling belly, then into chest, okay? So let's do it together, all right? Nice. And then just letting the breath come in on its own. Just resting and see if there's any yawning or movements that your body might want to make. Okay. Great. And just noticing sensations, feelings, thoughts, any pictures, any inner images. Just observing. You know, sort of more like in the Vipassana tradition. Just observing how the sensations and feelings come and go. Okay, yeah. Ah, no. You don't have the advantage I have. Okay, so why don't you just go into little groups of threes, and then each person will be, they'll be the experiencer, the guide, and then the observer. And just maybe 5 or 10 minutes, okay? So again, you don't want to get too deep into something. You want to just practice touching into, okay? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll ring the bell when, to change, yes, indeed.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.